Hi, this is the Michael J. Epstein Memorial Library, and you're listening to Freeform Radio 91.5 FM WMFO Medford.
Heaven anyway. Think I might regret it now. cemetery, making friends, trying in vain to breathe the fire we was born in. Catching rides to the outskirts, time fate between our teeth, sleeping in that old abandoned beach house, getting wasted in the heat. Yeah.
It is 12:09. You're listening to WMFO 91.5 WMFO Medford Tufts Freeform Radio. I'm your host, Reed, of Reed's Reading Room, and hope y'all are having a fine night tonight. It's pretty nice outside. It's like sweater weather in December, and it's getting out of a cold spell too. I thought that I... Sorry. In the background is Times Are Changing by Bob Dylan, the whole album. Now it's going. I thought I'm reading. This is Reed's Reading Room, so I'm reading Dharma Bums again by Jack Kerouac. Some people say that you don't read a good book just once, so I'm reading it again. And because when you read a book the first time, you're just trying to kind of grasp what's going on, you know, the setting, the people. The style of writing, you know, it's so different reading different authors. You have a different pace, and you have to look for what words they emphasize within their sentence structure, which impacts how your eyes gaze across the text, which can take a while to, you know, because a book, it is, you get out of it what you put in, you know, there's, if you read a book just glazing your eyes across the pages and the words and saying them to yourself in your head, but not maybe not connecting them to the whole paragraph, you know, to get the idea out of the paragraph, it's a totally different reading experience than if you're just skimming the surface versus if you take a lot of time to chew and swallow all of the words that have been written. Anyways, the point of that is that I'm trying to chew and swallow all that's there instead of, you know, just putting it in your mouth and spitting it out and saying that you know what it tastes like, you know. So I'll start. Mr. Crepe is a store, a restaurant, I guess. It's like a cafe in Davis Square, and I was in Davis just rambling along. I got Ben and Jerry's, you know, this was last night, which was a mistake because it was so impulsive, you know, to see the Ben and Jerry's, think, well, I sure would like to have an ice cream in my hand right now, you know, that would be nice to eat it. So I went in and I, it's always, do you, when you go up and get an ice cream, do you do the, hi, how are you? Good. How are you? Good. Okay. Now I'll order my ice cream. Or do you save everybody the hassle and just say, I would like a cookie dough, small, and a cake cone, please. I don't know what's preferred, because for you as a person going in to order the ice cream, this is your one ice cream order exchange experience of the day, right? So you put more emphasis on it than the person behind the counter. They have, for one, this is their job. Two, they have countless ice cream order experiences throughout the day, right? You are not their one and only, as much as you think that you are in your mind, but no. You are just one of many gluttonous beings that walking around, see the Ben and Jerry's and go in to buy the ice cream, right? So I think, because I've also worked a job where I'm working the cash register and people come up and order their food, and man, by the end of the day, you just want to kill a guy, you know? It's like, I'm not going to play the charade, you know? Just order the, I don't know how many, it's like a pound and a half for the muscles. Like, just order your food. I don't know. So point being, from that experience, I order the food right out. You know, I would like this, please. Because I don't know how to connect with you right here. And I don't think there's even the need for that, really. Let's save us both the trouble. I just want ice cream. You want to go home. I feel you. Can I have this, please? If you, you're behind the counter, you know, I'm sorry, but if you could hand me the apron and I could get behind there, I would happily scoop myself the ice cream. But that's just not the situation here, you know? So I'm sorry though, I gotta ask you for this, but could I please have a cookie dough ice cream small, please? I know I'm capable of doing it myself, but that's just not how it's set up here. You're the employee. Why don't they just have buckets of ice cream? Free, well, that's a grocery store, I guess. They do have that, but it's not the same. The whole ice cream parlor experience, to walk in and then to have to, you know, if there's nobody there, you still walk around the invisible line, you know, you don't take the straight path. That would seem so foreign. you know, like they have the little barrier so that if there's enough people, they can wrap around it to create a line. And I went in, and it would have been faster for me to, the counter, the register, and then all the ice creams set up were on my right. And then in the middle of the walkway for the customers, there was a little barrier to create the line section. And it would have been faster for me to stick to the right and go straight up to the counter. But no, I walked around. I took a left. I took a sharp left and walked around this thing that was in the middle of the room and forgot why. I am so, you know, we're all so just like doing things based on, there's no, if you take out the context of the line and you're just like, what is this thing in the room? Of course you would just walk, you wouldn't go around it. Why would you? It doesn't make any sense. But anyways, so I walk around the thing and I ask for the ice cream. And I ask for Rainbow Jimmy's. And she said Rainbow Sprinkles. I was like, yeah, Rainbow Jimmy's, man. They're Jimmy's. I don't want Rainbow Sprinkles. I want Rainbow Jimmy's. And then, I don't know if she misheard. She must have misheard me because she put on the Jimmy's and then looked at me. She was holding in one hand my complete ice cream order, cookie dough, cake cone, Rainbow Jimmy's, and then held this, like, gun. You know, it was like a blowtorch. And she was like, do you want this in a separate dish? Like, I don't know how to put this on top of your cone. It's against the rules to put more toppings on cones. I didn't know what to do with that. I was really perplexed. Like, how do I break this down into not being condescending? So I said, they're already there, aren't they? And she said, no, the whipped cream. I didn't mean to ask for whipped cream. But anyways, and I pay for it with this like little plastic card thing, you know, which makes it so meaningless. Like, I can spend, it doesn't mean a damn thing to stick, you know, to procreate the fucking chip into the chip hole. Doesn't mean a damn thing to me in terms of monetary exchange. But anyways, I missed the swipe. It's the whole thing, and then you gotta stand there like an idiot and wait for the chip to, you know, to process, and you're, but like, do we chat now? Is this a chat time? I stare at the chip until it's done. I don't know. I can't look at you. And we're going to make eye contact and be like, yeah, how's your day? I don't know how to do that. So I stare at the chip and it goes through. And then, it was $6.38 for a small ice cream. And man, that just doesn't feel right. $6. The U.S. dollar is going to go to nothing soon. I mean, you have to pay six of them for a small ice cream. What kind of currency is that, you know? Then what does $1 get you? A sixth of a small ice cream? That's nothing. That's a bite. Who wants a bite of ice cream? If you're having ice cream, do the thing, man. Pig out. Bite of ice cream in my ass for a dollar. I mean, it's not even an option. Even if you got something that was 99 cents, it would be tax and tip included. It'd be like $4, you know. It just, the dollar means nothing to nobody. The poor penny, the pennies, the dimes, the nickels, the quarters, they have this whole system. For what? They are neglected. Who's on the nickel? Who's on the nickel? If you know who's on the nickel, call in. I don't know. I have no idea who's on the nickel. 5 cents? 20 of them. 20 nickels make a dollar. You can't get jack nothing for a dollar. What do you get for a nickel? A thing you can flip in the air and it sucks. It's too small. You need a quarter. It's useless. Isn't it illegal to melt them down? I don't know. But anyways. So I ate the ice cream and God, it was good. But then I was cold. It was cold outside. I had an ice cream, you know, so everything's cold. And I looked across the street to Mr. Crepe. It's a place I've heard about. And it looked warm, and there were people, you know, like busy little rabbits on their computers. So I went in. And on the sign, on the door, it was like, bathrooms, not public, just for Mr. Crepe customers only. As if when you then buy something from Mr. Crepe, you're no longer part of the public. You are now a Mr. Crepe aficionado. But anyways, I go to the back. I sit at a table that's next to the bathroom. And that was the only one open. Well, that's not even true. I picked one that was in the back next to the bathroom instead of the middle of the room because I wanted to use the bathroom. And they put the code on the door, so there's like, dude, if you don't want people coming in to use your bathroom, set it up as so that when you buy something, you have to ask for a key or something. They put it on the front door, and then it was just, I peed, and I didn't buy a damn thing. I mean, it's a stupid system, but anyways. The whole place was, so crepe is like a French, you know, it's a French thing. I don't even know how to describe it. I'm not a cuisine expert, but man, I don't know who Mr. Crepe is or who thought to call it Mr. Crepe. I don't love it. I don't love that name, if I'm being honest. Let's go to Mr. Crepe. Who's Mr. Crepe? No, it's like this crepe place, but it's not really crepes. It's like, it's more like a gyro because their menu is like the crepe then filled with very American things like, I don't know, like 10 toppings. It just made into a sandwich. It was a sandwich store, but like really expensive sandwiches that weren't that good. It was like one was like balsamic apple cheese, some kind of cheese, and something that would be good in a sandwich, but it's just not meant for a crepe. Anyways, the whole thing was butchered, and in the table I was sitting at, it was like it had a cross. It had an X, you know, like a table has four legs. And underneath the top part of the table, the legs were connected with an X, which is just unnecessary. Why did you connect them like that? You know, I think a table can stand on its own. But the X, like, hit my knees. It was right at knee level, so I couldn't get close to the table. I was, like, a really uncomfortable. I had to, like, lay the table upon my quads. And there was people watching unsuccessfully. All my gazes were met, which is just, I don't want that. I don't want that. I just want to look at you. From not even like a sexual, the most non-sexual way. I just want to like geometrically intrigued way to look at, you know, like everybody looks so funny, you know? Like there was this guy and he should have been a, well, if he had lips, he would have been in the next movie, but kid had no lips, so you're screwed. Tom Holland doesn't have any lips and he gets by. And the no lip thing really ruins it for me, you know? You gotta have lips. How do you kiss? How do you kiss? Is it just all tongue? You just like open up and shoot it out? I don't know. But anyways, he didn't have any lips, but he had gray hair and these cheekbones and like solid eyebrows, just a big old head, you know? Like a lot of his genes went to like sculpting this dome of his. So, wow, good for you, man. It's a nice looking head. But then I'm looking for a long time. And when somebody looks up to look at you, they know that you've been staring at them for a while. By the way that you are just boom staring at them when they look up. And then you gaze away quickly. It's like, oh, you know that guy's been doing a bad thing. Oh, man, these computers are so bright. I don't know how to turn it off. It's really annoying. It's giving me a headache. But anyways. Did some writing. And then this whole group of people, you know, they're all busy on their little devices. And, boys wear Mr. Crepe shirts. And I don't know who Mr. Crepe is. Where's Mr. Crepe? Mr. Krabs? Is he in the office and his pile of money, you know? I don't know. Mr. Crepe. Okay, I'm gonna start Dharma Bombs. I'm on page 10. Somebody remember that. Dharma Bombs. Chapter 1. Hopping a freight out of Los Angeles at high noon one day in late September 1955, I got on a gondola and lay down with my duffel bag under my head and my knees crossed and contemplated the clouds as we rolled north to Santa Barbara. It was a local and I intended to sleep on the beach at Santa Barbara that night and catch another local to San Luis the next morning, or the first class freight all the way to San Francisco at 7 p.m. Somewhere near Calo, where Charlie Parker had been mad and relaxed back to normal health, a thin little bum climbed into my gondola as we headed into a sliding to give a train right of way and looked surprised to see me there. He established himself at the other end of the gondola and lay down facing me, with his head on his own miserable small pack, and said nothing. By and by, they blew the high ball whistle after the eastbound freight had smashed through on the main line, and we pulled out as the air got colder and the fog began to blow from the sea over the warm valleys of the coast. Both the little bum and I, after unsuccessful attempts to huddle on the cold steel and wraparounds, got up and paced back and forth and jumped and flapped arms at each of our ends of the gon. Pretty soon we headed into another sliding at a small railroad town and I'd figured I needed a poor boy of toke wine to complete the old dusk ran to Santa Barbara. Will you watch my pack while I run over there and get a bottle of wine? Sure thing. I jumped over the side and ran across the Highway 101 to the store and bought, besides wine, a little bread and candy. I ran back to my freight train, which had another 15 minutes to wait in the now warm, sunny scene. But it was late afternoon and bound to get cold soon. The little bum was sitting cross-legged at his end before a pitiful repast of one can call sardines. I took pity on him and went over and said, "How about a little wine to warm you up? Maybe you'd like some bread and cheese with your sardines." "Sure thing," he spoke from far away inside a little meek voice box, afraid or unwilling to assert himself. I'd bought the cheese 3 days ago in Mexico City before a long, cheap bus trip across places I can't pronounce, 2,000 long miles to the border at El Paso. He ate the cheese and bread and drank the wine with gusto and gratitude. I was pleased. I reminded myself of the line of the Diamond Sutra that says, "Practice charity without holding in mind any concepts of charity, for concept, after all, is just a word." I was very devout in those days and was practicing my religion devotions almost to perfection. Since then, I've become a little hypocritical about my lip service and a little tired and cynical, because now I have grown so old and neutral. But then I really believed in the reality of charity and kindness and humility and zeal and neutral tranquility and wisdom and ecstasy. And I believed that I was an old-time bhikkhu in modern clothes wandering the world, usually the immense triangular arc of the New York to Mexico City to San Francisco, in order to turn the wheel of true meaning or dharma and gain merit for my future as a future Buddha, as a future of hero in paradise. I had not yet met Jaffe Ryder yet, and I was about to, in the next week or so, or heard anything about Dharma bums, although at this time I was a perfect Dharma bum myself and considered myself a religious wanderer. The little bum in the gondola solidified all my beliefs by warming up to the wine and talking and finally whipping out a tiny slip of paper which contained a prayer by Saint Teresa, announcing that after her death she will return to the earth by showering it with roses from heaven forever for all living creatures. "Where'd you get this?" I asked. "Oh, I cut it out of a reading room magazine in Los Angeles a couple of years ago. I always carry it with me." "And you squat in boxcars and read it?" "Most every day." He ducked not much more than this. Didn't amplify on the subject to Saint Teresa, and was very modest about his religion and told me little about his personal life. He is the kind of thin, quiet little bum nobody pays much attention to, even in Skid Row, let alone Main Street. If a cop hustled him off, he hustled and disappeared, and if yard dicks were around in the big city yards when a freight was pulling out, chances are they never got out of sight. Got a sight of the little man hiding in the weeds and hopping on in the shadows. When I told him I was planning to hop the zipper first class freight train the next night, he said, "Ah, you mean the midnight ghost? Is that what you call the zipper? You must have been a railroad man on the railroad." I was a brakeman on the SP. "Well, we bums called it the midnight ghost, because you get on in L.A. and nobody sees you till you get on to San Francisco in the morning. The first thing flies so fast. 80 miles an hour on the straightaways, Pap." "That's right, but it gets mighty cold at night when you're flying up that north of up to the surf." "Surfs? That's right. And then the mountains down south of Margarita. Margarita, that's right, but I've rid that midnight ghost more times than I can count, I guess." "How many years since you've been home?" "More years than I care to count, I guess. Ohio was where I was from."
A bullet from the back of a bush took Medgar Evers' blood. A finger fired the trigger to his name. A handle hit out in the dark. A hand set the spark. Two eyes took the aim behind a man's brain. But he can't be blamed. He's only a pawn in their game. The South politician preaches to the poor white man. You got more than the blacks, don't complain. You're better than them, you've been born with white skin, they explain. And the Negro's name is used, it is plain, for the politician's gain as he rises to fame. And the poor white remains on the caboose of the train, but it ain't him to blame. He's only a pawn in their game. The deputy sheriffs, the soldiers, the governors get paid. And the marshals and cops get the same. But the poor white man's used in the hands of them all like a tool. He's taught in his school from the start by the rule that the laws are with him to protect his white skin, to keep up his hate, so he never thinks straight about the shape that he's in. But it ain't him to blame. He's only a pawn in their game. From the poverty shacks, he looks from the cracks to the tracks. And the hoofbeats pound in his brain. And he's taught how to walk in a pack, shoot in the back with his fist in a clinch. To hang and to lynch, to hide neath the hood, to kill with no pain, like a dog on a chain. He ain't got no name, but it ain't him to blame. He's only a pawn in their game. Today Medgar Evers was buried from the bullet he caught. They're lowering him down as a king. But when the shadowy sun sets on the one that fired the gun, you'll see by his grave on the stone that remains, carved next to his name, his epitaph plain. Only a pawn in their game. Oh, I'm sailing away, my own true love. I'm sailing away in the morning. Here's something I can send you from across the sea, from the place that I'll be landing. No, there's nothing you can send me, my own true love. There's nothing I'm wishing to be owning. Just to carry yourself back to me unspoiled, from across that lonesome ocean. Ah, but I just thought you might want something fine, made of silver or of golden, either from the mountains of Madrid or from the coast of Barcelona. And if I had the stars of the darkest night and the diamonds from the deepest ocean, I'd forsake them all for your sweet kiss. For that's all I'm wishing to be owning. But I might be gone a long old time, and it's only that I'm asking, is it something I can send you to remember me by, to make your time more easy passing? Oh, how can you ask me again? It only brings me sorrow, the same thing I would want today. I want again tomorrow. Oh, I got a letter on a lonesome day. It was from her ship, a sailing, saying I don't know when I'll be coming back again. It depends on how I'm feeling. If you, my love, must think that away, I'm sure your mind is a roaming. I'm sure your thoughts are not with me, but with the country to where you're going. So take heed of the western winds. Take heed of the stormy weather. And yes, there's something you can send back to me. Spanish boots are Spanish leather. Time will come up when the winds will stop and the breeze will cease to be breathing, like the stillness in the wind before the hurricane begins, the hour that the ship comes in. And the sea will split and the ships will hit, and the sands on the shoreline will be shaking, and the tide will sound and the waves will pound, and the morning will be a breaking. The fishes will laugh as they swim out of the path, and the seagulls will be smiling, and the rocks on the sand will proudly stand the hour that the ship comes in. And the words that are used for to get the ship confused will not be understood as the spoken, for the chains of the sea will have busted in the night and be buried out the bottom of the ocean. A song will lift as the mainsail shifts and the boat drifts onto the shoreline, and the sun will respect every face on the deck the hour that the ship comes in. And the sands will roll out a carpet of gold for your weary toes to be a-touching, and the ship's wise men will remind you once again that the whole wide world is watching. With a sleep still in their eyes, and they'll jerk from their beds and think they're dreaming, but they'll pinch themselves and squeal, and they'll know that it's for real the hour that the ship comes in. Then they'll raise their hands, saying, "We'll meet all your demands, but we'll shout from the bow, your days are numbered." And like Pharaoh's tribe, they'll be drowned in the tide, and like Goliath, they'll be conquered. Williams and Zinger killed poor Hattie Carroll with a cane that he twirled around his diamond ring finger at a Baltimore hotel society gathering. And the cops was called in, and his weapon took from him as they rode him in custody down to the station and booked Williams and Zinger for first-degree murder. But you who philosophize disgrace and criticize all fears, take the rag away from your face. Now ain't the time for your tears. Williams and Zinger, who had 24 years, owns a tobacco farm of 600 acres with rich, wealthy parents who provide and protect him, and high office relations in the politics of Maryland reacted to his deed with a shrug of his shoulders and swear words and sneering, and his tongue it was a snarling. And in a matter of minutes, on bail was out walking. But you who philosophize disgrace and criticize fears, take the rag away from your face. Now ain't the time for your tears. Hattie Carroll was made in the kitchen. She was 51 years old and gave birth to 10 children who carried the dishes and took out the garbage and never sat once at the head of the table and didn't even talk to the people at the table who just cleaned up all the food from the table and emptied the ashtrays on a whole other level. Got killed by a blow, lay slain by a cane that sailed through the air and came down through the room, doomed and determined to destroy all the gentle. And she never done nothing to Williams and Zinger. And you who philosophize disgrace and criticize all fears, take the rag away from your face. Now ain't the time for your tears. ¶¶ In the courtroom of honor, the judge pounded his gavel to show that all's equal and that the courts are on the level, and that the strings in the books ain't pulled and persuaded, and that even the nobles get properly handled once that the cops have chased after and caught 'em, and that the ladder of law has no top and no bottom, stared at the person who killed for no reason, who just happened to be feeling that way without warning. And he spoke through his cloak most deep and distinguished, and handed out strongly for penalty and repentance Williams and Zenger with a 6-month sentence. Ah, but you who philosophize disgrace and criticize all fears, bury the rain deep in your face, for now's the time for your tears. Oh, all the money that in my whole life I did spend, be it mine right or wrongfully, I let it slip gladly to my friends to tie up the time most forcefully. But the bottles are done, we've killed each one, and the table's full and overflowed, and the corner sign says it's closing time, so I'll bid farewell and be down the road. Oh, every girl that ever I've touched, I did not do it harmfully, and every girl that ever I've hurt, I did not do it knowingly. But to remain as friends, you need the time to make amends and stay behind. And since my feet are now fast and point away from the past, I'll bid farewell and be down the line. Oh, every foe that ever I faced, the cause was there before we came, and every cause that ever I fought it full without regret or shame. But the dark does die as the curtain is drawn, and somebody's eyes must meet the dawn. And if I see the day, I'd only have to stay, so I'll bid farewell in the night and be gone. Thank you.
Oh, every thought that strung a knot in my mind. I might go insane if it couldn't be sprung. But it's not to stand naked under unknowing eyes. It's for myself and my friends, my stories I sung. But the time ain't tall, if on time you depend, and no word is possessed by no special friend. And though the line is cut, it ain't quite the end. I'll just bid farewell till we meet again. Oh, a false clock tries to tick out my time, to disgrace, distract, and bother me. We'll be right back.
Hi, we are Jetpacks for Sale.
And you're listening to Freeform Radio, 91.5 FM, WMFO, Medford, Mass.